Where to Be a Woman is the podcast celebrating the best of women's well-being.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Richard Kagoy, and coming up on this edition of Focus on Africa, frustration in Nigeria following the abduction of almost 300 children. What's going on?
It's so unfortunate that 10 years after the abduction in Chibok, we are still having mass abduction in Nigeria. What is happening is an indication of the fact that all the talks about the prosecution of this war on terror is not giving us the right results.
Also, how the ongoing Red Sea crisis is affecting Ramadan celebrations in East Africa.
There can be no Ramadan without dates. We're taught through our religion that when we break fast, we must eat dates. So it's important our shipments get here.
And Nigerian Afrobeat star Asake is never far from controversy. He's once again upset his fans. We'll tell you why.
Asake is a very big artist. This particular song is not even in the top 10. Before, he would have been number one. So people are cancelling him gradually. The truth is that he's losing fans. Most people are saying it's a continuous mockery of the Christian religion.
But let's start today in Nigeria. And many of you would have seen this story in the news. It's hard to miss it. Almost 300 school children have been kidnapped in recent days in Kaduna State. Whenever school children are kidnapped in Nigeria, almost everyone reflects on the abduction of around 276 girls by Boko Haram in the northeastern town of Chibok 10 years ago. Now, the recent kidnappings surpasses that mass abduction in 2014 when militants kidnapped the schoolgirls from the dormitory. Nigeria has been struggling to contain its kidnapping epidemic for a number of years now. According to a Nigerian intelligence group, SBM, more than 3,600 people were abducted between July 2022 and June 2023. But the actual number could be far higher, as many people don't report kidnappings for fear of reprisals. Nigerian President Bola Tinubu was elected last year after running a campaign promising to end insecurity and kidnapping in Nigeria, condemned the abductions in a statement on Friday, saying, "The president directs security and intelligence agencies to immediately rescue the victims and ensure that justice is served against the perpetrators of these abominable acts." To get a better understanding of what's going on, I called up Dr. Manasseh Allen, a human rights activist and team member of the Bring Back Our Girls movement. So, Dr. Manasseh, we've reported extensively about a spate of mass abductions in Nigeria. First things first, what's really going on? What's behind the rise?
It's so unfortunate that 10 years after the abduction in Chibok on April 14, 2014, we are still having mass abduction in Nigeria. What is happening is an indication of the fact that all the talks about the prosecution of this war on terror is not giving us the right results. It's an indication of failure in terms of improvement on security and especially intelligence gathering and intelligence sharing among the security agencies.
Remind us, where are the majority of the kidnappings taking place and why?
Basically, these kidnappings are taking place in virtually almost every part of the country, because last week, Sunday, the abduction that happened around the IDP camps was in the far flank of Angala in Borno State, in the northeastern part of the country. This is a garrison town, and we have lots of security presence with trenches around the camps, but still IDPs were able to be abducted, around 300, as reported by the International Organization for Migration, Abuja office. And abductions have been happening in Kaduna for the past 8 years without any concrete plan to mitigate a further attack.
I'm just curious, because if you look at the profile of the people who are victims of abduction, majority of them are school children. And of course, you've talked about IDPs, internally displaced persons. Are they a soft target?
They are soft target, but the confusion here is that most of this abduction are happening in places where security presence are heavy. Kaduna states, for example, where we have a lot of military formation. The Nigerian Defense Academy is there, and lots of, you know, Air Force College of Technology. Chukwu local government is just a few kilometers from the Kaduna metropolis. In such location, clearly, there is nowhere you can go, and then you identify this forest in court they are talking about. So where and how is it possible that terrorists will come and then take away 280 students, as it's been reported? Our level of surveillance supposed to have increased 10 years after the abduction in Chibok. It has happened 10, 20 times since 2014. Then we from Chibok are still waiting for our children. For the past 10 years, we still have over 87 that are not rescued, with all the assurances coming from the federal government and other security agencies. Honestly, it is unacceptable, and it is very disappointing for a country like Nigeria.
There doesn't seem to be assurance from Nigerian authorities that they're able to clamp down or address this issue once and for all, because it's something that's been persistent over the past 10 years. What are Nigerians saying about this?
People are so disappointed that this thing keeps repeating itself, but Nigerian authority are not approaching this issue with the kind of anger that it deserves, the kind of urgency that it deserves. Because if the authority responded with such magnitude of anger, show of force and might to prove to these insurgents that it is not games as usual, Nigeria cannot be taken for granted. Nigeria cannot be pushed to a level that we can do nothing about our abducted children. The terrorists must get the message. So what we want is responding with the kind of urgency that will pursue, overtake, recover the children, and then eliminate the terrorists.
What's been the response from the Nigerian authorities? What are they saying? Are there any indications of when possibly these girls could be rescued?
Up to now, aside the statement issued by International Organization for Migration, there's no official statement from anybody. The officials in that camp, as states and federal representatives, have switched off their phone for over 1 week. No media house can even get them to respond to questions. So as it is now, Nigerians are blank, waiting for what will be done.
But President Tinubu has said that he's quite confident that the children who had been abducted will certainly be released very soon.
As I speak, we still have 87 of the girls missing, 87 of them 10 years after. I don't believe anything from President Bola Tinubu, and I can look at him in the face and I tell him that he cannot do that, because it's not possible. And as I keep saying, we would have recovered the remaining 87 Chibok girls that were abducted 10 years ago.
So, Dr. Manasseh, you work with the Bring Back Our Girls movement. Help us understand, what happens to, you know, the victims when they are released? Talking about children here, talking about the girls.
There are a lot of concern, because some of the girls that have been rescued are not being rehabilitated. Some of them are kept with the repentant Boko Haram together in the same camp. Nothing is being done to them in such a way that they will see a clear departure from what they were seeing while they were in Boko Haram custody. We've been speaking for years that other non-governmental organizations need to be in place to see to it that different forms of rehabilitation are being deployed in such a way that everyone that is being rescued is given attention and is being attended to in such a way that they can see the love from the other people and then get back to their livelihood as it used to be. Yes, it will be difficult. It won't be easy, especially those that have been abducted and then coming back with 2-3 children from the terrorists, their life have been completely changed. But then they must be shown a form of love and attention that they are not rejected by their communities. Majority of them are not being properly rehabilitated, so they are still bitter, they are still angry, they still look like they are being neglected.
And what sort of rehabilitation are we talking about? What kind of aftercare is supposed to be, you know, offered to some of these victims?
What we are expecting them to do is to bring in experts in psychosocial support, experts in livelihood development, experts in education, and lots more. Those that have been, their education has been truncated should be given a form of getting back to school, either on scholarship or any kind of support to continue their education. The children that some of them are bringing should be taken up by government, or a certain kind of child support should be provided in such a way that single moms like them could take care of their children without hassle, because educating 2, 3, 4 children from terrorists that you don't know. Some of them are even coming from different fathers. It may not be easy for young girls that were abducted at 13, 14, 15.
Have you had the chance of speaking to some of these victims? What do they tell you? How they've managed to live through such a very traumatic experience?
It has been so difficult for so many of them. I've spoken to so many victims, not just among the Chibok girls. I've spoken to so many other victims from different places that have been in custody of the terrorists for long. They have witnessed people dying in front of them, some from childbirth, some from bombs being thrown on top of them, some from, you know, marching on mines and the rest. So for them coming out alive, some of them are grateful for having life. The only bitterness with them is that the bitterness of the country failing them for not responding to get them out on time.
Thank you so much, Dr. Manasseh Allen.
Welcome. Thank you very much.
East African countries rely on the stability of the Red Sea region. This part of the world is used as a primary route for shipping goods to countries along that coastline. But that corridor is being affected by the ongoing disruptions in the area. In fact, it's not only Africa's supply chains that are facing severe disruption, but global ones too. You may remember this, but it's always worth a reminder. The attacks are being carried out by Houthi fighters in Yemen. They've targeted commercial vessels, which has resulted in many of the world's biggest shipping companies diverting journeys away from the Red Sea, which then impacts supply. The Houthi group had declared its support for the Palestinian group Hamas following the war against Israel and Hamas. So the Houthis said they were targeting ships traveling to Israel because of the conflict. This has had a huge impact on East African countries, where demand is especially high around Ramadan. Audrey Brown has been speaking to the BBC's Peter Mwangangi, who went to Kenya's port city of Mombasa to find out more about the impact this has had on East Africa.
So I'm going to start by asking you just to sketch for us in very broad terms first, what kind of an impact the disruption of supply chains due to attacks by Houthi rebels in the Red Sea are having on the cost of living in the region.
So for you to get a sense of what the impact is, you have to understand how the economies of East African countries are structured. Most of them are net importers, meaning that they import more goods from foreign countries than they export. And that means they are sending more money abroad than receiving back. So that has an impact in terms of weakening of their currencies. And this is what we have been witnessing in recent years because of what has been happening globally. When you have that situation, that means that if global prices are shifting, then the region is exposed and customers are exposed to high costs of goods. To give an example is at the onset of the Russia-Ukraine war, we saw a number of goods being affected, for example, wheat and fertilizer and oil. To this moment, the price of oil and some of these goods has gone up. So we are talking about disruptions at a time when the economies in this region are already feeling the impact of all these other factors.
So how are retailers and traders in the region coping with the price increases and the delays in shipments?
So retailers and traders are coping with the price increase by passing down the cost to consumers. Others are having to work around to ensure that they have smooth flow of supply. So some of them are having to order their goods early. One of those who ordered early is a trader in Mombasa who I spoke to. His name is Awad Omar. He owns a shop there and he sells dates that are imported from Saudi Arabia, as well as honey from countries like Yemen and Germany. As we approach or enter the holy month of Ramadan, he had to order early. So in the process, he missed out on the government's 20-day tax exemption window for Ramadan that started on the 1st of March.
There can be no Ramadan without dates. We're taught through our religion that when we break fast, we must eat dates. If not one, at least three. So it's important our shipments get here. We have a type of dates called ajwa, for example. We used to sell it at around $16 per kilo, but now we have to add an extra $1 or $2. We've been charged more on freight costs. There are high dollar exchange rates. Also, We usually get free duty on imported dates, which only takes effect a week before Ramadan, but ours arrived early.
Fuad Omar, a trader, tells me that dates, which is a sweet fruit, which is a staple food item during fasting, could soon be out of reach for many.
This year, the sale of dates will be difficult because when we compare to last year, one box of dates would go for about $10. But now, it's going for $17. And you know, we can't buy expensive and then sell cheap.
So prices are going up and people are missing out on some of the profits that they could have made during this period because of these disruptions. So could you explain how these delays are affecting other sectors beyond consumer goods?
People who import goods in bulk, like cereals, fertilizer, fuel, vehicles, farm machinery, they prefer using the sea route because it's much cheaper when you compare to air or overland. And here we are talking about different continents, getting goods across different continents. I also spoke to Salim Mbarak, a clearing and forwarding agent who acts on behalf of importers and exporters. And he says business has not been good.
I used to handle 30 containers in a month for one client. Because of that impact, the number of containers for the month will definitely reduce because the frequency now will be affected because the frequency is not there. Whereas a vessel used to do weekly service to this part of the region, they are now doing maybe once in a month. So that has impacted negatively in terms of what I would have received and cleared and therefore earned as my agency fees.
So people are having to make allowances for the changes. They've got to go the longer way around. What are the additional costs involved? And I imagine that time is one of those things that they have to measure as well, not just fuel.
Indeed, time is one of those additional costs. And we are talking about a delay of more than 10 days when you compare to the Red Sea route. And when you talk about 10 days, that means you have to factor in fuel costs. You have to factor in payment to crew. You have to factor in shipping insurance. You have to factor in other costs. And I was speaking to one of the traders and they were telling me that another cost that has now just been added is the contingency adjustment charge, which could be as high as $600 per a 20-foot container. All these are extra charges that they had not foreseen before. So what that means is that when these goods get here and they finally get to the consumers, the extra cost will definitely be passed on to the consumers.
People will remember that there was a major disruption in the Suez Canal, you know, with that ship that was blocking movement through the canal. I'm just wondering, how does the current situation compare with other disruptions like that?
There have been other disruptions on that channel before, but some of them have been short-term. In 2021, there was the case of Ever Given, which is the giant container ship that blocked the Suez Canal and other vessels could not get through. I spoke to the CEO of the Kenya Ships Agents Association, Juma Teller, about this, and he explained about how these disruptions clouded with even greater uncertainty.
In 2021, we had a blockage at the Suez Canal with also some, you know, disruption like this. Though that time it was not as bad as this one, because it was just a question of trying to remove the vessel that was blocking the Suez Canal. But you see, with this one, we really don't know how long these things will happen.
Peter, do we know of any initiatives for resolving the security challenges in the Red Sea?
There have been a number of them. We have seen the UK and the US carrying out airstrikes against drones and missiles that are from the Houthi rebels, shooting them down. But this issue keeps recurring. So analysts say perhaps there is a need to go deeper and resolve the root cause of the issues in Yemen and also across that channel to ensure that there is guaranteed security for ships that are passing through that channel.
Audrey Brown speaking to the BBC's Peter Mwangangi about the huge impact of the Houthis' targeting of ships traveling to Israel on East Africa. Fans of the Nigerian Afrobeatster Asake are calling on him to take down the video of his latest song, Only Me. In it, he's seen wearing Christian regalia with a halo round his head, dancing provocatively in a church. The video also shows the singer throwing money at his dancers. There's been no comment from his management so far, but the video has been widely criticized on social media. One fan on X, formerly known as Twitter, said Asake keeps disrespecting Christianity in his music videos. Last year, the artist came under fire for his video Bandana that was done in collaboration with Fireboy TML. Now, that video depicted black goats sitting in a church. Around him, people can be seen in the pews, each with a flame above their heads. My colleague Godfrey Brown has been speaking to entertainment journalist Sunny Green Itodo, who's based in Abuja.
Christian fans are upset about the video, Christian, Muslims alike, because even the Muslims, they are not in support of what Asake is doing. Asake is a Muslim, by the way, but the Muslims, they are not in support of what he did in that video. That is the sentiment online. And the reason Christians are kicking against the video is because there is no correlation between the video and the lyrics of the song. The song is about money, loss. There is nothing godly about it, so to say.
Right.
So they felt offended by his decision to use a Christian setting for the video.
Right. And people, blasphemy is a real thing in Nigeria, right? And people, and it's upsetting because a lot of people also are quite religious. So when we talk about artistic freedom, creativity, and freedom of expression, will that cut any ice with people?
Artists naturally have freedom to express themselves in whichever way they choose. But it is a sign of insensitivity to put out blasphemous art in a country like Nigeria that is hyper-religious. You understand me?
Yes.
Because while you are free to create as an artist, you must bear in mind that it's the fans that are the ones that are going to appreciate your music, that the ones that are releasing it for. So if your fans are offended by the art you are creating, you need to check yourself. Artists have every freedom in this world to create whatever art and express themselves in whichever way they feel. But they must consider the fans. It's not just enough to make music or any other form of art, but we must look at the reception of it. So this is where the issue is. Nigerians are still struggling to differentiate between art and religion. Maybe in the Western world, what Asake did may not be considered as blasphemous. But in a country like Nigeria, they are very sentimental when it comes to religion. So they felt really offended by Asake's video, especially the fact that it has no correlation with the lyrics. The video has no correlation with the lyrics. He was singing about body, money. And then in the video, you are distributing communion. You are dressed like a priest. So this is what offended the Christians.
It's not the first time he's crossed swords, as it were, with religious people, right? He did it also in another song of his earlier. Tell us about that.
Asake did something similar in the video of Bandana. In that video, it was like he was taking goats to church. So Christians felt offended by that because making the house of God look like a place for animals or somewhere where animals should be. They felt offended by that, especially the fact that he's a Muslim and he has never used a mosque to concept any of his videos. He has never used a mosque for any of his art. These are the questions that Christians are asking.
And how does Asake respond when people ask him those questions? What does he say in defense of what he portrays in his videos?
What he does is to ignore.
So he doesn't pay any attention, he doesn't respond to any criticism, he doesn't respond to people questioning him on social media, nothing.
And it is even appalling that he hasn't come out to explain or to like educate the fans about the concept of his art. There was a time where Rema was accused of using satanic symbols at his show at London's O2 Arena.
Are you talking about Asake still? Or you're talking about a different artist, right? Okay.
I'm trying to make a point. When you are being criticized, you need to come out and clear your name. You need to come out and clear the air. There was the time Rema was accused of using satanic symbols at his show at the London's O2 Arena. He came out to explain to the fans that those symbols, they were replicates of the art of Benin Kingdom, where he's from, that they are not satanic. So after he made that clarification, the criticism went down. A lot of fans stopped criticizing him. They understood the concept of the art that he tried to showcase. That's what people are expecting Asake to come and do. He can come out to explain his decision to shoot the video in the church setting and explain the meaning of the distribution of Holy Communion in that video so that people will understand. Because right now, people find it hard while he will use a church setting for a music video that has nothing in correlation with Christianity. The lyrics is secular and all that. I'm just telling you what people are saying, the opinion of fans on social media.
Yeah, no, I understand.
So this is what they are saying.
So has he lost any fans? Have people stopped listening to his music? Have they stopped streaming it? Have they stopped buying it?
Yes, bit by bit. A lot of the fans are complaining. They are canceling his music. They are, especially the video, this video that he released for Sundays. If you go to YouTube, you notice that streams are poor compared to his previous release. Because Asake is a very big artist. Unlike before, this particular song is not even in the top 10 of most streaming platforms in Nigeria. Before, it would have been number one. So people are canceling him gradually. But the truth is that he's losing fans. And he needs to clarify his continuous use of Christian, or I don't want to call it a mockery like they say, but most people are saying it's a continuous mockery of the Christian religion.
Isn't Asake the artist where those tragic events happened in London at the Brixton Academy, where people were killed and there was a stampede?
Yes, he's the artist. He's the same artist.
He came in for a lot of flack for that as well, didn't he?
Yeah, but the fact that he acknowledged that and he kind of sympathized with the victims, that wasn't... And even at his O2 show, O2 Arena show, he still paid tribute to the victims. Although some people were saying that he should have done more, but at least he handled that to some extent. Unlike his continuing snubbing of this issue of mockery of blaspheming. Like, he has never responded to this issue of blaspheming. At least for the stampede, he kind of like paid tribute to the victim, although that was also a stain on his career at some point. Even here in Nigeria, people talked about it, but at least he recognizes that.
Yeah, and I suppose a loss of life compared to clashing beliefs are two different things altogether. But tell me this.
Yeah.
It's on YouTube, right? Are people demanding that YouTube take it down? Is there any legal breach of community guidelines, YouTube's community guidelines, or will it stay on there because, you know, nothing can be done about it?
Okay. Most of the people that are criticizing Asake's video, some of them don't know that they can bring down the video. They are not taking any action to ensure that the video is put down. They are just asking him to take it down.
Audrey Brown speaking to entertainment journalist Sunny Green Itodo. Thanks for listening to this podcast. This episode was put together by Yvette Twakira Maria, Lola Shrua, Sunita Nahar, and Stefania Okereke. Kanisha was in charge, and Chris Ablakwa was a technical producer. Andrew Lombard was the editor. I'm Richard Kagoe. We'll talk again next time.
It all started with me asking my friends and family to write letters to my daughter, Coco, sharing their experiences and giving her advice for her life ahead. The idea blossomed into Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service, the podcast where, with the help of your letters, I'm creating a handbook to life full of advice for daughters everywhere. Listen now by searching for Dear Daughter wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Dear Daughter.